Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Christian architect Duo Dickinson.
So my sense is that you shape the buildings because the culture shapes the buildings. God shapes you. You're not shaped by the buildings you make. You are shaped independent of what we do, actually.
Duo Dickinson, next. Coming up today, a discussion with Duo Dickinson. He's an architect, and Spencer Dahlke talks with him about his recent piece, Do Buildings Reflect Spiritual Change? It appears in Mockingbird magazine.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. You're an architect. How did God lead you into that particular calling?
Well, it's pretty classic. So I grew up with, you know, the classic greatest generation parents, meaning they would tell you to go watch television. And I grew up in a high school that basically had a guy who was a really nice guy as your advisor who said, like, oh, where do you want to go? So it was always left to each of us baby boomers to determine our future. Right? Part of the determining the future was I was okay in school, and there was a program at the University of Buffalo, and it allowed high school students to take classes. So I auditioned in, you know, you have to all the grades and things. I auditioned in, and I got two senior level, 400 level courses, one in Shakespeare and one in English history from the Magna Carta to the Reform Act of 1832. And I had an unbelievably great time and really bonded with the professors, so much so that I visited one of them in England the year following. I went to both of them at the end of the last class. And we did bond. I mean, it was like we were friends. And so I said, this is fantastic. If I were to pursue English or pursue history, what would be the ultimate end game of that? They both said the exact same thing. They didn't know each other. They said, well, then you'd get a PhD and you'd actually become a professor. You'd write some. You then would, if you really were good, you'd become a professor that actually becomes a PhD for people that are getting the degree you have. So I said, so you'd be getting an education to teach other people to get an education to teach other people to get an education. And I went, there's no product. It probably is a God thing. I never put it in those terms, but it probably was a God thing where I'm lying in bed when I'm 17 years old and it's August of 1972. And I'm lying in bed and I'm going, I mean, I'm 17. I must determine the rest of my life right now. And I looked at my library that was on the wall in the moonlight, and I thought about the fact that every night before I went to sleep, if I needed to put myself to sleep, I would think about how things were made. And I saw how a lot of the books I had were fine arts derived, and I said, you know what, I'll be an architect. Back then, there were only two ways to do it. One is with a Bachelor of Architecture, which is 5 years, kind of a master's and a bachelor's combined, or a master's. And I opted for the five, because I wanted to do it right away. And so I opted for the best school in the country, Cornell. I'm licensed before I'm 27, 26, the earliest you could possibly be licensed. That's it. And it's one of these things where if I had any perspective, I probably wouldn't have done that path because it's pretty brutal. We started with 140 kids in a terrific program, and we graduated on time, 38. So basically probably 50 or 60 graduated, but that meant more than half of the students that got into the best program in the country decided not to do this or failed. So it was, is that a good thing? I don't think it's a good thing. Because I teach now, and I tell all the kids I teach that essentially my job is to have you find what you do through this. And that human first approach directly reflects the architecture design thing that I do, which is, it's not that I am the designer. It's that we are humans. We really discover what God has given us, not just as a person, but in this world, what God has given us. And it's so overwhelmingly complicated and so overwhelmingly unknowable. It's hard when you're an architect, but you have to have kind of essential faith in things you can't control. And if there's one profession that is based on control, it's architecture. If you realize the fundament of what the building is out of your control, even though you're doing everything, that's one of those things which you only know because you know what you don't know. And that's really hard for humans to know what we don't know.
before I get to some of the things that you mentioned there, you had some really interesting thoughts in this article that you wrote for Mockingbird magazine, Do Buildings Reflect Spiritual Change? What prompted you to write this article? Is this a thing you've been thinking about a lot, or what happened?
Oh my goodness. See, I'm 70 years old, right? So I would say, you know, there's that whole first part where you're going crazy in your 20s and 30s to just have something to offer. You then have work, but then you've got children, if you chose my path, and your life is this weird mud wrestling match between children and work and marriage. Then when the children go away, you have this thing where you, if things work out, you've established this place that people either want or don't want, but they want enough that you can make money at it. The children are basically gone. They're baked. It's over. They're finished. You know, you were there for them, but they've got their own lives. At that stage, I went, well, why am I doing this? And then what am I actually doing? What I realize is that when you do so many houses, we've done over 600 houses, you do so many places that have got a spiritual direction, maybe 100 things that have a spiritual direction, that you realize that everything that I do has got the essence of capturing the humanity of the people that are in it. And I honestly believe that God made us. And if that is true, then I'm capturing some aspect of God in everything I do. And I'm not alone in this. Other architects have furtively said this. It's very heretical to actually, in the academic intellectual world, to basically say there are things you don't control, that you don't define. And a great architect named Christopher Alexander, he laid out in many books and everything this incredibly extreme, overwrought way of designing things that is absolutely based on the essential humanity of every person. And it's almost like an academic overreach into getting the bona fides of control of the design process with, and if you read his later writings, with an acknowledgement of 100% that the designer is not in control. And that weird dynamic of humans having agency, facility, and not control is to me almost the essence of what faith is. Because you think about the rest of the universe and they have no conception there's anything but themselves. They are what they are. They don't really know about death. They don't really know about anything except what they deal with every day. And we, this small group of organisms, know about death, know there's something more that we can't understand. And the more that we end up knowing in this last 100 years, the more we end up understanding how there are things we might not ever know, because our abilities and our agency has got limits of understanding and capacity to diagnose and data form things that are just almost surreally complicated. And I've got some very good friends that are very hard scientists, and they are very angry at me because I say to them, so how's that gravity thing going? I mean, you know what gravity is, right? You've measured it, but what is that gravity thing again? How does that work? And they just want to shoot me because, you know, the entire arc of human intellectual focus has been on things like gravity and time. I mean, a very good friend of mine, one of my very best friends, was on the top quark experiment at CERN. He was very upset at the time, and he is upset that it was called the God particle, because he's an atheist, and he really says, this is absolutely absurd. It was a marketing ploy. It's baloney. But I did say, weren't you guys thinking that you would actually have a more definitive arc of understanding? And he said, well, some of us were. Some of us really thought that this would be the Rosetta Stone, where you'd actually see how the subatomic parts worked. You'd see how they actually formed and reformed and changed, and you'd get a little bit like getting the genome, you would get a map of how mass and anything is actually put together. It just showed that you didn't know a lot. There's so much more to understand. So that in this hot esoteric end is exactly what I discovered in the world of design, where everybody tries to put some label on design, or they did up until the last, to the internet, about whether it's classical or modern or traditional or whatever, they try to sort of make it into a style, and the style is all baloney, because the truth is it's whether or not you find it reaches to something you don't control yourself. And that's the beauty thing, which is a nightmare of illegitimacy and excusing ignorance, I just try to make beauty, says the designer. You don't make beauty, you discover beauty. So I'm sorry, you didn't do that. That was already done. You just found it.
I'm trying to wrap my mind a little bit around this idea of beauty being not a thing that we control. Can I float an idea by you and you tell me how this maybe aligns with what you're trying to say? Something I've been reading recently. You're an architect. I consider myself a thespian. I really like acting. I've been reading Michael Chekhov, and he writes about why study acting technique. And he says we have to have an objective standard for acting technique because that's how we progress and advance and discover, maybe like you're saying, new ways of portraying our character.
It's exactly the same. And I don't think it's just the same in aesthetic things. I think it's the same in practical things. You know, I teach second year students, and you have to teach them, this sounds really stupid, but it's true, the nuts and bolts of buildability. That's another horrible word, but things that either work or don't work. And you say, if you, in order to do things that are conscientiously in violation of working as a commentary on cultural something, and there's a lot of architecture called breakitecture, or a lot of architecture that's done with a middle finger put in the face of the culture, saying, I'm an artist and I'm going to do what I want. And the truth is that middle finger of the arts is literally based on knowledge, not just based on the ego of the artist, or it becomes meaningless. So to have meaning, you've got to be able to know what is necessary and then violate that. That's sort of the education thing. I had a son who is a great musician, not for money anymore, but he really was one of the best French horn players going in high school, anywhere. All he did his entire time was figure out how to mechanically generate the sounds that were possible. Now, he never got to the level where he could earn a living doing that, because the vast majority of people do not, and in acting as well. But you've got to get the tools to either be a good chef, a good architect, a good French horn player. I even think things like a doctor or an engineer. I do think that there is an element of creative mind presence or heart presence or faith presence in every single thing that is enhanced if you're open to it. The problem is that we're conditioned from the time we're born to be a transactional, achievement-based, objective, validating world. We're in a system of risk and reward, of commerce, of purchase and object. That's the dynamic that we're grown up in. You know, if you're a good person, you get this. If you're a bad person, you'll be punished that way. And then we project that into faith, and you have a heaven and hell, which is probably the two things that have probably most damaged faith in the 21st century of anything. Because again, just like the physicists saying, we have the God particle. Well, we're not God, so we can't say what heaven and hell is. But we've really tried and really been really specific about what that is. And we aren't the people that created it. And you just say, well, I have faith that there's something that I can't understand that has deeper meaning than I can fathom. But there is a reality of the presence of something which is inherently good in every human, mm-hmm. no matter who they are. And that's also very unpopular, because now half the country thinks the other half is bad. So you've got good and bad in this metastasized dynamic of hatred, which is just everywhere. And the people like me that are saying, I don't hate anybody, get yelled at. You have to hate them. This is false equivalence. No, no, we're all the same. No, we're not. There's really bad people. And I don't care who you're talking to, by the way. It doesn't matter left or right or blue or red. They're bad people. And somehow that validates you, because you are not bad. It's a symbol of basically how humans can cope with what they don't know. And it's the same thing in architecture. It's the same thing in playing the French horn. What you don't know is what you don't know. So you've got to invent the rationalization that says you do know it, that you do control it, that you can actually define it. There's this one letter that Michelangelo wrote, and it's obtuse, and I don't know Italian, but the obtuse meandering thing he says to a friend has been distilled to probably something which is maybe, I think he meant this, but this is kind of like shaky. The phrase that's used is, I carve and carve and carve until I set the angel free. So there's something there, and all we can do is the physical acts of discovery, and we have to know how to carve to do it, which is not a spiritual thing. It's a mechanical, direct productive learning exercise. And that means you do it well and you good approbation, you do it badly, you get anger, rejection, judgment. But you have to do something to get in closer contact with what you will probably never have contact with. I mean, I do think actually faith is much more important than religion. I think that the icons and rituals and all the rest that architects have been obsessed with in buildings is just a shorthand you hope triggers a response. And I think that that's sad. And I've gotten into trouble writing articles. Actually, people felt quite insulted when I said, when you design a place of worship, no matter what it is, if you rely on the icons and rituals to generate connection, well, that just begs the question that you can understand more than what other people have determined to be triggers. The truth is, the triggers are the real problem, I think, with a lot of our culture, because now we've distilled what our culture has given us in these memes and other things to be absolute binary switches of I get it, I don't get it. There's no texture of understanding why this has any impact in your perception. It's just the dating app of yes, no. And your generation, I would imagine you're young enough that probably the default mechanism of finding another human being for many people of your generation was the internet. And you think of that as being kind of this weird dissociative objectification, but that's just what it is. By the way, you can't say that's bad. It's just us. And us is, by the way, God. We're not God, but we were made by something, right? So if you're made by something, something in you is doing that because that was given to you to do.
My guest today is Duo Dickinson. He's an architect and a writer and the author of Do Buildings Reflect Spiritual Change, Beauty, and God, for that matter, is something we stumble into with Mockingbird Magazine. Going back to a comment you made about, you suggested maybe architects should get away from using like icons, imagery, things like this. Here at Pilgrim Radio, we tend to lean more Protestant. So maybe you're just talking about like specifically like Catholic Orthodox ways of building churches, or
I've done Jewish temples. I did a Quaker Friends Hall. I've done many secular buildings where every building form has the ability to have these symbolic referential elements to them that are really plug and play. The great thing about the Christian sort of declination of how buildings are organized with words like narthex and nave and chancel and gallery and all these elements, they really are one large construction that manifests the rituals. And that is true whether it's Catholic, where there's enormous emphasis on iconic connection. This person is rendered in this way, and seeing into the eyes or the presence of that human transports you into the divinity that was reflected in that person. That exoskeletal thing, which is part of the reason I'm a Protestant as well, is that essentially the embodiment of a connection to something greater than you that is not you is a problem for me. You only have the world that has been given to you. But the thing is, it's you and the world. It's not you, an icon, and God. There isn't like a lens. It all is direct. And maybe that has to do with the fact that, you know, that the people say, you know, it's very religious. People say, so when were you saved? And I'm going like, yeah, I wasn't. I said, it's just never always been there. We would go to church and stuff, but there were not really religious people in my family, but they went to church. And it's been there. And I do think that there is an element of understanding in the scientific analysis of what people perceive that is trending towards the idea that there are perceived and maybe tangible outcomes to inexplicably and unavoidably emotional truths that are as hard-edged as cancer or anything, that people have faith. They don't die as much in certain ways. People have faith. They don't have depression or addiction as much as others. And there's a tangible benefit that is inexplicable Otherwise, you'd make a pill for it, like Ozempic or something for the spirit. You're like, take a pill and you'll believe in God. That just does not happen. And so maybe in 100 years, there'll be a trend towards that acceptance and belief in something which is not ritualistic and not iconic, but human.
The question that you ask, do buildings reflect spiritual change? And as I'm trying to kind of wrap my mind around what exactly you're kind of trying to say, maybe this is the question that I need to be asking is, what is the spiritual change that you see our buildings reflecting?
Architects continually quote the line, we shape our buildings and then they shape us. And I found out recently that was Winston Churchill talking after they destroyed the Houses of Parliament, arguing in a world where modernism as architectural style became the requisite for legitimacy, intellectual legitimacy. He was lobbying for not modernism, about a replication of what was there as a connection to history, because that would shape England. And then he was voted out of office. So my sense is that you shape the buildings because the culture shapes the buildings. God shapes you. You're not shaped by the buildings you make. You are shaped independent of what we do, actually. The shaping going on is, to me, how the manifestation of anything happens, whether it's food or entertainment or anything else. And the more I've read about this and talked to people, the people I've talked to that know this agree with me, that basically in 1810, 1795 in England, 1840 in America, 1880 or 90 in other places, the Industrial Revolution took an absolutely settled law reality and destroyed it. Royalty, state religion, class distinction, genealogical determination in extremis. The Industrial Revolution, which we did, changed that. It wasn't laws, and it wasn't religion, and it wasn't anything except us figuring out how to do more stuff in a way that changed the way we lived our lives. Well, that's exactly what's happening now. And it's only in these last 20 or 30 years, because I'm old enough now to know what it was like in the analog world. It's only now that we're seeing extreme fractures without direction. We have no idea what it's going to be like in 5 or 10 years, because we've never had the last decade that we had of this almost civil war level of hatred within the country. But without a geographic, really, or anything commercial aspect, it's just almost an ideological change. And I do think religion in the Northeast and in the West, not so much in the South of America, but all throughout Europe forever. There's a nice article that just came out in Living Church that I did just now, and basically talks about the fact that Europe has experienced what we have experienced two generations ago, about these very sacred buildings becoming totally profane because the people just don't use them anymore. And yet at the same time, still 85, 88% of us know there's something more than this happening. And now your generation, almost a majority of you, find connection not in buildings, but in the natural world. It's just where they find God. You can't say that's wrong, and you can't say that's illegitimate. What you can say is, though, that it's completely undefined. It's not understood. And I do think that when you had church or synagogue or mosque or something, you had a portal that you understood and framed your ignorance in. And faith became something that was shaped by the intellect versus faith that's being perceived by the individual. So when the individual has primacy and everybody's made individually in the image of God, then that says to me, on one level, you have more capacity to get closer to that than if you're putting things in the context of buildings and ceremonies and icons. It becomes more the questions then given to you directly by the world. What do you think? What do you believe? I think we're in the middle of a challenge that's going to go on way after I'm dead. And maybe it'll never get answered, but at least it'll be better formed. I mean, I think about what early Christianity must have been like. Must have been this horrific freak show of like pre-existing cult-based things of determination of primacy and value and meaning. in with this weird Jesus thing that was somewhere over here, one of these guys, you know, they're doing this thing. You know, it took several hundred years, but it became clear that this was kind of touched people in ways that just wasn't there. And it was not about learning or teaching or imposing. It's about discovering that this is true. So if it's true, it's true. It's not like you've made this up or whatever. This is just what you perceive. And that's exactly the same thing in buildings. You know, whether or not a building is good or bad is functionally determined, absolutely. And you can determine how a building will not work, will leak, will fall apart, will trip you, will be confusing. That's absolutely within our control. But if you solve those things, and I do think the buildings I've done pretty much do, if they solve those practical things, then you're left with, are you coming to a connection which is beyond what the physical accommodation is? The thing that architects rely on is the fitness, commodity, and delight appellation that is created in several different places, but basically in the classical world. And fitness and commodity, by Vitruvius, and then it was Goethe and some other people would say fitness, meaning it's got to stand up. Commodity, meaning it's got to be functional. Commodity, it's commodious. The last one is delight. And the delight part has been a real conundrum in teaching and evaluating architecture because it's not intellectual. It's perception. It's reaction.
Say you have fiat power to design buildings for the universal church in a way that it would reflect where we are. How would you design the church building in a way that would reflect what you perceive to be a healthy spirituality? And I might tack on to that, are there ways that the church has throughout history designed its church buildings that are worth preserving?
Oh, we could have another show based just on this. There's nothing, and I mean zero, wrong with old stuff. When you have a building that has a beckoning presence, meaning the spires, the recesses, the doors, the focus, that says, come here with shadow and light, it actually makes a place that you can see, a shape you can perceive, then a space you can see, then a portal you can determine, and you go in. And then you're greeted in what is normally called it's traditionally called a narthex, but a place of reception that then sends you into a larger place of collection that then gets you to another place of focus that then has you sort of perceive something that is not connected to humans, but to something beyond humans. That's the religious experience of everyone. And the number one thing is two things: the profanity of competing in the rest of the world, meaning it's a thing in the rest of the world, but then the protection and actually nurturing and out nourishment of safety. So if you go into a place and you feel safe, not just safe, it's not going to fall down on you and you're out of the weather, but safe in that your personal presence has been not only received but accommodated by the nature of the place you're sitting, by the nature of the things that are in front of you, by then looking beyond yourself, to have the freedom to be alone or to be together. That human reflection is in every building, whether it's a house or a bedroom. Every one of these things is basically us. So I give a talk every year to my second year design students, architecture is human. And I think that that's true of everything. And I think human is so directly distinctive from all other life and even just matter that to me has got God in it as its fundament.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, architect Duo Dickinson, writer of the article, Do Buildings Reflect Spiritual Change? To read it, go to mbird.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at this same time for another edition of His People.